Spanish.
Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hi, it's Therapist Kelly. Dr. Deborah is out today, so I have a super special guest host. His name is Michael Robinson.
This is Michael, and if anybody forgets my name, it's extremely common, so I hope you don't.
So Michael is a friend of mine, and we actually just went to Great Wolf Lodge this weekend. So he's completely like sworn off children for the rest of his life. And yeah, I mean, you can speak to that a little bit.
Yeah, so I've never seen so much energy and
craziness
in my entire life. And every time I'd get in the elevator to go back up to the room, every parent would just kind of give each other the look.
Yes.
Like, this is happening.
Exactly. Well, they had alcohol. Like, I don't know if you saw, there was like a total little area for alcohol for the parents.
There was a free pour alcohol station for these people to literally just guzzle it down.
Right. So, okay. So last week, I'll just dip into last week. I loved our guest from last week. Her name was Ann Grant. She was a corporate litigator and she wrote the book, TheDivorceHacker.com or The Divorce Hacker, and her website's TheDivorceHacker.com. And she really talked about how it was fascinating. It was just kind of taking care of yourself during a divorce, emotionally, financially, things like that. So yeah, she was wonderful.
And I actually just finished a divorce myself, so I would have loved to have listened to that, but I will be definitely going to thedivorcehacker.com because I think there's some lingering stuff there that I would love to read about.
So I'm going to just dive right in. So I'm so excited. One of my favorite guests, and I'm so scared I'm going to butcher her name, so please correct me, but is Dr. Saida Desilier. And she is the author of Desire, Turning Our Attention Towards Our True Desires Can Open the Doors to Fully Live Life on Our Own Terms. Dr. Saida wants to live in a world filled with audacious, sexually sovereign women living life on their own terms. As a thought leader and body philosopher, she has authored The Emergence of the Sensual Woman. Dr. Saida is renowned for being the founder of the modern Jade Egg Movement and visionary spokesperson for sexuality, and is currently contributing on the vaginal microbiome. I want to hear about that. She has created 8 online courses to assist women to successfully embody their sensuality while enhancing their sexual health, plus The Daring Project, a growing online membership of women from around the world, assisting women to audaciously move from being a victim to confidently thriving in life. Welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited to be back, and I'm so curious what you think since the last time we chatted. I know you really wanted to dive into
the
Jade Egg. Curious how you've been.
I'm obsessed with the Jade Egg. Like, hands down, by far. I think I probably told you the story, but I'll literally put it. So for those of you who don't know, it's basically, well, you can describe it better, but it's an egg that you put in your vagina and it, you don't feel it. And it basically, I don't know what magical properties it has, but it's just very, I don't know, it makes me feel very empowered and sexual. And I absolutely love it. And I need to get better at doing it every day, but I absolutely love it. But yeah, if you can speak a little bit about it, I'm sure our listeners would want to know.
Sure. So typically it's like you said, a small piece of nephrite jade that's in the shape of an egg. We use it intravaginally, that's internally. There's physical practices, all the benefits to your glands and the different tissues. If you use it correctly, obviously, there's many ways you can use it incorrectly. But for the most part, if you use it correctly, you get a lot of incredible benefits. Even if you just have a small practice where you just wear it around your house, for example, that can have some incredible effects. It's not the quality of the stone that does it. It's the fact that you're building a neurological bridge from your conscious, aware mind into your pelvic floor and vagina this was a disconnected, intentionally disconnected when we were a lot younger, the way we're socialized. Mm-hmm. And so having something there really rebuilds those neural pathways. So you actually start to cognate real sensation that's always happening anyways, but we're just kind of socialized out of noticing. Mm-hmm. So now you're starting to notice and it feels good.
It really does. And, you know, the benefits that I've noticed have been the strong pelvic floor versus like when you sneeze and a little bit of pee comes out, like this will nip this right in the bud, I have to say. And I'm speaking freely because I think it helped me and it's going to help a lot of women in that sense. And that's,
yes.
Is that right? Because you're strengthening that muscle?
Yes. And for some women who have too much tension, for example, if there's like stages of prolapse or undue pelvic tension, if they're very athletic or they've had traumatic births or type of surgeries that might have led to some scar tissue, it will also support that, but you use it in a very different way. So you're using it to create softness, suppleness, and mm-hmm. openness in the pelvic floor, which is essential for orgasm, actually, and long-lived vitality. So it's quite a diverse tool.
And you're doing a medical study on this. I read in the bio.
Yeah, so there's been a lot of controversy around the jade egg, and there's been a lot of, unfortunately, unsubstantiated claims by medical doctors on it. They actually don't know what they're talking about. I don't even know if they've ever even held one or used one themselves. And when I confronted these individuals, they would not respond to me because as a doctor, you have a very important role in people's lives. What you say becomes gold. And if what you say is unsubstantiated, then that's like fake gold, mm-hmm. if you know what I mean. So it's very important to my colleague, who's a luminary OBGYN, works with thousands of women at a hospital, also teaches other doctors. She decided that we needed to do a study, but I can't actually be involved in it because it would create a bias.
Mm-hmm.
So she went off and found one of the world's best vagina biome experts and proposed the study to her. So it's moving forward, but obviously with things that are legitimate, they take time to put into practice because you've got to get the right paperwork and the right signatures. So it's moving forward. And the reason we want to do that is to demonstrate that the egg, just like a sex toy or a finger or whatever, these things are, the fingers are porous, sex toys can be porous. Penises are definitely porous. And so you're not getting sick from exposure to those things.
Mm-hmm.
So we just want to demonstrate against the false claims that jade eggs can cause toxic shock syndrome, which is absolutely not the case.
Right. So for those of you who don't know what we're talking about, so a lot of people feel that the jade egg is unsanitary and can cause yeast infections or UTIs and things of that sort. Because, yeah, I think even my gynecologist might have said that. And I was like, yeah, I'm not listening to that. But it's
just common, you know, it's like the lowest common denominator. You Google and you get basically, like I said, if unsubstantiated claims are done by doctors, now that gets media mm-hmm. and nobody wants to listen to anything else. So the only thing that will counter that is a real study.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we've moved forward. And I'm really excited to get the results of that.
And I love how there's an actual expert, a vaginal micro, like an actual expert, like, so cool.
Yeah, like a PhD who studies that part of the body.
Is there an actual
duration
of time that you would want to cap it off to be inside of you for medical reasons?
You know, just in my experience, having led this for over 25 years and having students literally from, 16, 17 different cultures, and just sitting with moments where women sometimes have panicked because the egg won't come out. The worst, very worst case that I've ever been exposed to was a person who was so scared. She created so much tension. The egg did not come out for 15 days.
Wow.
When she finally relaxed, it did come out. Because I just had to coach her to relax.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So when it finally came out, she never had an infection. She never had any problems. She didn't have pelvic pain during the experience. It just kind of stayed in there.
Uh-huh.
So that was like the worst, 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 most extreme. For most ladies, it could just be like 6 hours and they're mm-hmm. a little bit nervous. So then they're like tightening and it's impossible to push it out when you tighten.
Mm-hmm.
So it's fairly common where women can have it stuck for a few hours. 15 days is like the extreme end. I'd never heard of that until that happened.
Wow. It's amazing. So let's shift gears a little bit and talk about your new book, Desire. Very, very excited.
Yes.
So tell us why you wanted to write this.
I wanted to write it because, well, there were several reasons. One, it just had to be written. You know, you just get a feeling sometimes in your life like, wow, like I have to do this. I don't know why, but I just have to do it. And I could feel that there was a book that wanted to come through back in 2014. And at that point, I didn't know what it was going to be about specifically, but I knew it would be about pleasure leading the way in my life. I was doing an experiment at that point every day, asking myself, what would my pleasure love today? And actually attempting and doing my best to follow that every day. It wasn't always easy, but that was, you know, my experiment. And then all this stuff started happening around Me Too and a lot of people being outed and all these things going on in our society where, once again, desire was going to go through another phase of being vilified.
Mm-hmm.
For a very long time, we've vilified desire. We have made it the essence of human suffering. And I wanted to propose something very different. I wanted to propose, if it's been around for as long as we have, maybe it's natural. Maybe it's a force of nature. And maybe, just maybe, our relationship to it is what's skewed, not the actual desire itself. So that's what the book looks like. It's like, wow, what is this powerful force? And to me, it's literally like the voice of your own essence calling you into your most magnificent life. And you feel it as an ache in your body and you're motivated. You're like, wow, I want this thing. I want it so bad. Like my heart is aching with it, whether it's love or a child or a contribution, et cetera. Mm. And then it gets hijacked, and it gets hijacked by social mandates and social ideals. So the book really looks at that. Here's the true desire. It's pure. It's existence. But here's what happens when we put it through the filter of our social conditioning. And I know that for myself, my journey with desire has been a very big one, a huge inquiry in looking at, wow, you know, there's so many things in my life I thought I really wanted, but those were actually mandated desires. And when I finally got them, it was kind of a meh experience,
mm-hmm.
instead of the ultimate happiness or fulfillment I was expecting to have from pursuing that.
And I love, because Michael's big into music, I love how your book is structured around different songs of desire. And
yes.
Why did you choose that?
Well, I think for me, if we don't have a semblance of beauty in our lives, we miss the point of being alive. It's not just to-do lists and structures and these things. Beauty plays a really important role in life. And I felt like desire was our own unique symphony in our life. It was going to show up in a very unique way, but that it was harmonious with other people and actually life itself. So that's why I visualized it as a symphony. And it's why I broke it down into very unique songs. For example, the song of Eros, the desire for sex. It's usually the one we associate the most with desire. But then there's also the song of procreation, the deep yearning for people to bring forth children. Then there's perhaps the desire for rapture, which is a really interesting take on desire because it's weaving in our yearning to know God or spirituality, whatever we want to call it, as a calling, as a yearning to know it, the state of rapture. So there's six songs that I define in the book, and I think they're all very important songs. They're part of the human experience, and most of us will touch in on one or three or all at some point in our life.
And would...
I have to say, actually, not to hijack the conversation, but just having been through a divorce, I'm resonating with a lot of what you're saying in terms of I've had a lot of heightened desires in the last 6 months or so, because it's very recent, whether it's emotional desires, sexual desires, it's all kind of has come to a head. So everything you're saying definitely resonates a lot with me. It's all, there's a million desires kind of all coming out at the same time. It's very interesting.
I love that, Michael. Also, because there's a part of the book where, what if you don't feel any desire for anything?
Hmm.
What if it's kind of silent? The songs are quiet and there's no symphony, because that's true for most of us at some point or another. Mm-hmm. And why does that happen? So I have a look at that in the book, because I think it's important. A lot of people could read the book and go, gosh, I don't feel anything. This doesn't apply to me. But it still really applies. So desire never goes away. It just kind of hibernates. And there's important moments for that. It's like an integration time of life. So, Michael, I love what you're saying, because maybe in your relationship there was a time when you stopped living truly life on your own terms. Like, what would the most gorgeous, fulfilling life be for Michael? And then there's almost like you can't feel what you would love. And then with the opportunity for the experience you're just having, where it's a redesigning of relationships, you might still be friends with your partner, but you're going to relate in a different way. Now what that has done is open up the floodgates. Suddenly you're like, wow, I would love this and I would love that. And gosh, I haven't even touched on this thing over here for so long. It would be amazing to touch that. And I think that's really important. That ebb and flow of desire in our lives is important to acknowledge.
Yeah. And some of the desire I've had has been misguided because, like you said, the floodgates opened and, you know, there's, let's just use the water analogy. The water's flowing all over the place. And, you know, some of it's going in the right spot. Some of it's not. And it's kind of how you navigate through all that and try to do it the best you can.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
So part of the book, Michael, is what I want to do is normalize desire in such a way that it becomes a benevolent force in our lives, where we actually go, wow, I have an internal compass that's trustable. My only job is to say yes and then do what's obvious. Now, if those things get hijacked, this is what's fun about the book, is I have you lean in a little further and visualize the fulfillment of this thing that you think you deeply want right now. And when you get to that place where you have it here and now, what's happening? What do you feel? And sometimes simply through the act of having that experience with the desire, it's completed and the tension of it dissipates. So it could have been a temporary desire. Maybe it's for chocolate, for example, as a silly example. Or maybe it is like you've been in a sexless marriage for 10 years and suddenly you're like, wow, I just really want to make love to like 10,000 women. And, you know, if you sit with that for a while, you're like, what is it that I really want?
Mm-hmm.
What is it that, you know, if I took that all the way to the end and I could have that, what is it that I'm actually looking for? And you let yourself feel that state, then you realize that you already have it. So that's what's really fun about desire and fulfillment, is we've been conditioned for two things. The desire is kind of bad and it's going to lead us astray and it causes all our suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And two, that fulfillment is this thing we get at the end of something.
Right.
Rather than understanding fulfillment is a state of being. You can actually enter it in any moment, at any time. And that's what's beautiful about this life, is that as you go for something that really matters. We're talking about this. If you left that desire unsung, that song, and you were on your deathbed, you would feel tremendous ache and regret that mm-hmm. that's the one thing you didn't say yes to and go for in your mm-hmm. life. It's the things that matter so much to your soul that's why it keeps coming up. And mm-hmm. for some people, it might be contribution. Maybe there's something that must be born of you, that must come forward in this world to either support humanity or to change even just one person's life. And it's so important. Your heart won't let it go.
Mm.
So it's like giving people a chance to step away from the cacophony of all these socially mandated desires with this promise of fulfillment, and instead shift into the truth of their own symphonic, the beautiful resonance of their true heart's desire, and noticing that they can actually step into the experience of fulfillment all along the way of doing what's obvious towards expressing that.
So can you give us a couple examples of maybe people you've worked with where they've sort of suppressed or repressed those desires? And then once they kind of gave into it, and, you know, maybe you can give a couple examples of that.
Yeah, sure. So, one of my clients, she had been a Jehovah's Witness for a large part of her young life, and sexuality is a big taboo. So she was a virgin at the age of 29. And not only that, she'd had so much conditioning that her body was sinful, that touch was sinful, that sexuality was sinful. She was very conflicted because there was a part of her that kept feeling like it was nice to touch her body, even not even masturbating, but just like putting a hand on herself and just, you know, comforting herself. That was also a source of great shame and guilt for her. So when I met her and she started to explore just very slowly the possibility that this desire of hers to know her sensual sexual self was a natural calling, mm-hmm. a healthy calling of a deep relationship with herself. And then she could create that in her own way, in her own language. It didn't have to look like me or even use my orientation. She now, I mean, I'm blown away. This woman in just a short period of year, a few years, initially, obviously, she was disoriented coming into dating and all of that. When you've not done it and you're 29, it's disorienting because you don't have the, you know, you're not well lubricated socially around that stuff. You don't have the practice of being awkward as a teenager and right. growing into a confident adult. So she went through a few, let's say, relationships that were not healthy for her because it was the first man to just say yes to her and give her attention. So she just thought, oh, that's it. He said yes, so this is it. Thankfully, with, you know, just coming back and relating with herself and a little bit of coaching and understanding of what it actually means to create this for yourself, she is now deeply in love with a man who profoundly respects her, and their sexuality is blossomed and it's healthy and it's deep and it's profound. And I'm just so proud of her. And she's having full body orgasms and just from like nothing in full repression to that in a short few years. That's that beautiful. To me is an incredible example of the resiliency of our human spirit. Mm-hmm. And the beauty of our true desires and what it can happen, the healing that can happen when we say yes to those.
Sure. Wow.
So I was going to ask, and you've kind of brought this up several times, is the analogy of desire being like a symphony. And I love that word, and I actually love going to symphonies. And Kelly and I actually have gone to a few like orchestral type of events. So I just think when you say desire is like a symphony, I think that is kind of a beautiful and powerful statement. So what exactly does that mean?
Right. So when you're sitting in a symphony, I don't know about you, but I actually can't sit still. When that range of instrument and that range of talent, and it's almost like a holy experience for me to be immersed in a beautiful symphony. My body cannot sit still. I get moved. I'm moved emotionally. I move physically. I'm blank mentally. Like it's nice. It's this moment of like just pure being. And I feel that way about desire when we're really tuned into desire, is that we're moved emotionally, that things that deeply matter to us start to become more obvious. There's an emotive quality to an ache and a yearning. There's a physical side to desire. We can feel it in ourselves. It's like if you really want a baby, men or women, if they want a child, they feel it. They feel it in their body as this very powerful physical, visceral experience of wanting to bring forth a child. So what I was attempting to create as a picture is that desire can be a very emotive, physically touching force. And that's actually how it communicates to us. It's not this weird like mental image or a concept. It's an actual lived experience. Desire is it's like an energy. It's like, how would you say, like your cells are translating into sensation that which your essence wants you to bring out into the world. And I find that amazing. And it definitely, my experience of a symphony is very similar to what I just described.
It's beautiful. So I want to talk about orgasms for a minute. So
of course.
I know, I knew you'd be comfortable with that.
That was an abrupt shift.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, you know what? We got to go straight here. So Can you, because I imagine there are a lot of people listening who are, who have never experienced one, want to learn how to have more. Is there anything you can say to that to kind of give us some nice tips?
Yes. So the first thing is that I think orgasm, there's two kinds. So there's a kind that you sort of self-induce. You do certain things to yourself, or you have a particular experience, and then you have what we call the experience of orgasm. And then there's a continual orgasm that we're not aware of, most of us, until we actually build the consciousness around it. And it's like this ever pervasive flow of vitality and turn on. And so I call those more like passive or yin orgasms. And they're, it's just a baseline of life force that's moving through you. That's one thing that we all have. Mm-hmm. So you don't need to pursue that. It's more like, wow, is that possible? And how would it become possible to open up to actually feel that? Mm-hmm. And the thing that opens us the most is being willing to track our turn on all the time. And a lot of us are not. So for example, when I started to do this, I felt my body was inappropriate half the time. I'm like, you're turned on now in this situation? Like, really?
It's really funny. Uh-huh.
And I remember just like laughing, going, it's okay. I'm going to give myself permission to feel lit up whenever I feel lit up and not make it wrong. So that was the first step. So if people are really interested in having a much more ongoing experience of feeling lit up, turned on, switched on, then it has to start with our permission. Permission to track and say yes. And here's the caveat. We don't have to do anything physical about it. You don't have to go off and masturbate. You don't have to engage someone sexually. You just get to feel that switched on deliciousness that's moving through in that moment. And it's all yours. And you can actually use it to fuel the rest of your life. Mm. Now, for the self-induced orgasms, for people who haven't had those experiences, and I know it's actually fairly common, that, again, we're psychosexual beings. That means that how we're feeling, if we're not feeling open and safe and expressed and connected to what actually turns us on, it's a lot harder to self-induce, say, a peak experience, a peak orgasm, than it is when we are actually feeling relaxed and open and connected to what we would love. So I would say that would be the first step, is what would completely delight you, and are you daring enough to even just whisper it to your own heart? Because that's where it starts. You don't have to tell anybody. Mm-hmm. But can you whisper it to your own heart and give yourself permission to have it? So when it shows up, you don't shut it down right away. You actually go, oh my God, here it is. Mm-hmm. And you let yourself indulge in that moment, even if it's momentary. I mean, some orgasms don't last that long, but they're still very delicious and enlivening.
Now, would you say it's healthy to, let's say, indulge in orgasms as like a novelty as well?
Well, yes. Mm-hmm. So Eros loves novelty, and intimacy loves safety. Mm-hmm. So if we create too much safety, meaning we try and control the entire experience, then Eros kind of goes yawn and doesn't really want to play. So there is an element of creating agreements and safety, and then within that scope, creating a little mystique, trying something new, that maybe just a different room in the house, or maybe a different kind of music, or I don't know, just something new and novel, and could be very, very simple. Mm-hmm. Some people have never looked into someone else's eyes when they have sex. That could be a pretty interesting experience. So there's a lot of ways that we can bring novelty into an intimate and safe experience, and then allow ourselves to have that. And, you know, for me, it's like erotic innocence. Mm-hmm. If we can really let ourselves have erotic innocence and explore and just have it be okay. And sometimes we're like, wow, okay, I'm never going to do that again. That was interesting. Mm-hmm. I'm never going to do that again. You know, we're allowed to do that. It doesn't mean anything about us. It doesn't have to be part of our identity. But it's an erotic curiosity, exploration. And in the book, I actually talk about, this is one of the five stages of erotic evolution, is erotic exploration. And if you don't go through that phase of development in your sex life, it's a very important and crucial phase for your own eros to evolve and grow. So definitely exploration is important.
So we've been talking with Dr. Sayeda Desole. Did I say it right? Is it close?
Yes.
Oh, good.
Yes, it's close.
And she's the author of Desire. So I want to talk a little bit, because I'm listening to you and I'm like, yes, I agree with everything you say. And then I think about genders and I think that men grew up with this and this is just very normal. It's like, oh yeah, it's great to have desire. You're that's very normal for men. And I feel like for women, it's still this idea that, you know, women shouldn't really have that much desire. It's mostly a man's type of thing. And I'm curious if you've, you know, yeah, what you have to say about that and your experience.
When you say those things, I want to bite somebody.
Yeah, I know.
I'm like, ah!
Yeah.
So gender aside, sexuality is, if you look at it, it's everywhere, even in flowers, right? So the way this biological planet is based is that sexuality is the way that things thrive. So men, women aside, we are sexual beings. Men, women aside, whatever your orientation, however you identify yourself, you are a sexual being. You're born that way. You die that way. Everything in between, you're still a sexual being. So all the social conditioning is what harms us. Mm-hmm. They did some very interesting studies. I want to just mention this one study. Do you know the quick date kind of formula where you're speed dating?
Yeah, sure.
So they have the women seated and then the men rotate and they speed date. And then from that study, they're like, okay, men are sexually aggressive and women are passive, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Well, some really smart scientists went, what happens if we do a role reversal where the men are stationary and the women rotate? And guess what they found? Women are sexually aggressive and men are sexually
right.
passive.
Exactly. Yeah.
So here's the thing. Desire exists in all of us. And how it expresses itself is unique to each of us. So I really want to encourage individuals to feel at home enough in themselves to allow, even in their own heart, just it's okay for me to want to have whatever it is that I want to have. So for example, for some women, they really want slow, slow, slow touch. Slow in a female version is, like if you translate that to a man, tends to be really fast. And the man's like, I am going slow, but to mm-hmm. a woman, it feels fast. So for her to give herself permission to want slow, we're just talking about slowness here, mm-hmm. can feel really threatening because her partner is either never doing that, or for her to voice slow feels like it's confrontational. I mean, there's so much social conditioning around us voicing what we would love. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the maturity process that emerges when we become a little bit more centered in our own truth as a sexual being, mm-hmm. and that we're, you know, sexually sovereign. I'm allowed to have, you know, the desires that I have, and then finding fun ways, because here's the thing, sex has to be fun. It can't be this really tough, heady
right.
place where we have all these concepts of how it should look like and how it should feel. Like, my God, no wonder orgasms don't exist when we mm-hmm. approach it this way. So if we can approach it more like, well, how would you love to hear someone tell you to go slowly? Would you like to, could you just go slow? You always do this fast. Like, that's not really a turn on. Or, oh my God, every time you go slow, it's just so, I'm losing my mind. Like, hello, it's like a whole other communication. So we get to be playful and explore. And so the number one thing, Kelly, for me is we have to learn to give it to ourselves first.
Right.
Especially women. Mm-hmm. Especially. You've got to train, like if you want slow, then touch yourself very slowly and notice how confronting it is. When you touch yourself slowly, you have to deeply relax and surrender. And for a lot of women, this is a big challenge.
Yes.
So I actually,
it's not all on the partner. Yeah. Go ahead, Michael.
No, sorry about that. So my current partner, And this is actually resonating with me more than I could possibly tell you. So, yeah, there's a difference in terms of individual like speeds and all of that that you'd like. And this was actually brought up recently, and she brought it up to me in a comical way, and it was actually incredible because it really expressed. Really expressed to me, you know, what her needs were, but she did it in like a gentle, comical way. She made like a reference to like a jackhammer versus like a like a bunny rabbit or something, and then we both just got on the same page, and it was perfect. Right. And yeah, I think you need to be sensitive to you know, your partner's sensibility as well. So mm-hmm. And it was done really, really well.
Yeah, and I wanted to say, it's not always women who want slow and tender. I recently met a couple where the woman is very aggressive sexually, and I'm speaking with the man, and he's overwhelmed. He's been with her a long time, but he's overwhelmed. He's like, the slightest touch of a breeze is so arousing to me. It's like his nervous system is geared to slow, subtle, you know, contact, and hers is to, like, you know, spank my butt as hard as you can kind of thing. So they have a lot to negotiate there, and traditionally there would be a lot of conflict for him because he's supposed to be the sexual aggressor or the aggressive one. Sure. Sexually. So there's psychologically some conflict that he's having about not being a real man, for example. And I said, no, you're wired, your erotic wiring is just different, and that's okay. You just have to find a place where your needs can also be met by your partner. It's not always just... Mm-hmm. One way. It's a two-way dance.
And I imagine this is quite common where one partner in the relationship has a really high sex drive and the other partner has a very low sex drive. And kind of what do you suggest on that front? And you have two totally different levels.
Yeah, I've been that. I've been the partner with the really high sex drive.
I was thinking that would be you.
I have too. I am no longer married.
Yeah,
I was married to someone who, you know, maybe once a month would was fine for him.
Wow.
And that was really hard. It was just really hard. So I got very, very, very good at my solo cultivation. It was just became essential. Otherwise, I was just going to be walking around resentful and angry and all the time. Mm-hmm. So the solo cultivation, where I would just move my own erotic energy for myself regularly, and I don't just mean masturbation, I mean like really being a good lover to myself and giving myself the quality of attention and intimacy that I was craving. Often what would happen is when I would come to a place where I would actually feel good and satiated in myself, he would then somehow be magnetized to me and start to give me the very things I'd been giving myself. So I found that really intriguing. I think also it would be important to see, why is the partner having low libido? My partner was really depressed. Mm-hmm. So when people are depressed, it's hard. So what are the things that they could do in their lives to feel more alive outside of the relationship? The hardest part in these types of relationships is to take, like, we're not meant to take it personally. It feels really deeply personal, but it really isn't. It's no reflection on us if our partner is just has a different type of libido.
Mm-hmm.
Libido for me is always related to how open and free are we in our psyche. So when we're feeling more shut down in our bodies, it's a reflection also of what's going on for us on a deeper subconscious level.
Mm-hmm.
So I love the exploration of, if I'm feeling really far distance from my desire and a far distance from even the physical yearning in my body, what do I need to feel alive again? What do I need? And it's not, the standard isn't how do I get to feel alive as much as Saida. The standard is, what do I need to feel alive for myself?
Mm-hmm.
The standard is our own self. And that's really important, because I think what happens is people compare themselves to what's out there or different people, and then they're like, wow, I'm just not like that.
Right.
And we're not meant to be like that. So that's a tough one. For the one who has a lot of energy, then I would definitely say, like, dance more, exercise more, and, you know, have a regular self-loving experience so that you're moving that sexual energy and it's not shutting down. The person that has less, start to investigate just gently. There's nothing wrong having less, but just, would there be things that I could shift in my life It would just make me feel more vital, more attractive, more alive, more connected, and just see what arises from that.
Mm. Wow. This topic I could talk about for days on end. I find it absolutely fascinating. I'm wondering, because I bet you deal with a lot of people whose religion has sort of, I don't know, had them shut down basically sexually, and how, you know, people who are coming out of that, what you say to them, where they, you don't want to kind of, you know, insult them about their upbringing, but talk, you know, how do you shift that mindset?
Yeah, with a lot of respect. The number one thing for me is, if we do not respect people's innate erotic intelligence, we should not be doing this work. And so the primary piece is, do I see them as powerful? Do I deeply respect their erotic intelligence, no matter where they're at in their lives, no matter where they come from? That's primary. And that is translated simply through my limbic resonance. Like, these are the principles I stand on, and people can feel that. So they tend to open when I'm around them. Yeah, they feel seen. They don't feel judged. And then we start to discuss the mandates that were put upon them from a very young age, and whether or not they feel that those mandates are still true and are reflecting their current choice. And if it's not reflecting their current choice, what would be ways in which they could change, move towards change that would feel integrous to them? So I never tell people how to have sex. It's not my job. Mm-hmm. But what I'm concerned with is, how integrated are you with your choices? How empowered are you with taking not only your normal life, but also your sensual and sexual life into your own hands and designing it in a way that feels integrous and beautiful?
Mm, so nice. And you talk a little bit about being heart sick. And so what is this cure for this sickness?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, gosh, I see, you know, that it was really evident when I spent time in a culture where, from babies to elders, their hearts, if we had a percentage of openness, I would say they were 100% open 100% of the time. I mean, it was the most discombobulating experience as a Westerner coming into that, because we guard our hearts. Mm-hmm. We've had so many experiences. We tell kids from a young age, don't trust strangers, don't trust this, don't. So we're so guarded. And so that's what I refer to as heart sickness, is this social mandates of what's allowed, like who we're allowed to love and how much we're allowed to love, and the conditions of that love. And so I think the first step is just to recognize that we're swimming in this sea of consent, that we have particular views on how much love is okay and who we're allowed to love, etc. So then, once we get to see that we're in that soup, and actually human beings want to be connected, we're mammals, all mammals want to be connected, then how do we do that in a way where it feels safe? Because in our culture right now, it doesn't feel that safe to walk around with a wide open heart. It feels like people are going to pick on you and hurt you and attack you, etc. And that's true. It's very, very vulnerable. For me, the place to start was, can I be more open with myself? And then from there, can I extend that deep respect of self to just one other? Mm. And that was the slow reclamation of my heart space. Mm-hmm. And now I find, it's so consistent. It must have something to do with me. Mm-hmm. But almost everyone I meet is so loving and so open. Mm. Where they trust me with their babies almost instantly. Like, do you mind holding my child while I go? I'm like, I don't even know this person. So I think a lot of that was, you know, self-cultivated. And I put this out in the world that I deeply respect to whomever I'm meeting. Mm-hmm. And then I can feel an officer laugh at, how would you say, kind in the face of fear versus shutting down, if that makes sense.
Well, it's so fun. I was just going to, I opened to page 143. And it says, the handbrake of fear. Fear numbs our human spirit, dampens our will, and puts out the fire of passion. So maybe you can speak a little bit about how fear plays a role in desire.
Yes, absolutely. Let's first just talk physiology, right?
Sure.
If there's a saber-toothed tiger coming, do you think that you're going to be primed for sex in that moment?
No.
No.
I would.
Do you think you're going to be primed for digestion?
No.
No. You're running because you're not even going to fight that thing. It's too big. You're like, you've got to move. You got to get out of there fast. This is a much older conditioning than our very, very recent modern times where it's actually fairly safe to exist right now. There's not like creatures trying to kill us every corner we turn unless you're in a war zone or deep in a jungle. So fear on a physiological level, it overrides all the systems. And when you override all the systems, now you're not in optimal living mode, you're in survival mode. This isn't meant to be a long-term condition.
Mm-hmm.
However, because humans are conditioned to pay attention to things that are going wrong for survival purposes, we tend to more notice what's wrong than what's right. And if we do that for too long and there's too many wrong things that are out of our control, for example, you know, just the nuclear power of another country, I don't know, whatever a person's thinking about that feels really out of their control. Now you're not primed to notice what feels good. You're not primed to even want to enter pleasure or even eat that well. You're going to eat for survival at best. And you're not even breathing properly anymore. You're shallow breathing, the whole systems. And this really ages us very, very rapidly. So fear is a detriment, mm-hmm. absolutely. So we need to start looking at it and going, what's real? And what are these conceptual ideas of fear, like the hypothetical fear? Like if I walk down a dark alley, I might get attacked. But I never walk down dark alleys. So why am I even contemplating that and freaking myself out? I'm just never going to do that. So it's about a little bit taking stock. For many women that I meet who've had trauma early in life, the wiring in their brains has been crossed. So sometimes they feel safe when it's actually dangerous because that's how they were raised. And sometimes they feel unsafe when it's totally safe.
Right.
So the first step in that case would be to start literally. So what I get clients to do is squeeze your body and breathe and look around. But you have to do it while you squeeze your body. This is a reassuring gesture to the body. You're squeezing the body. You're telling yourself you're safe. And you're looking around and you're noticing I'm actually safe. Right this mm-hmm. second. There's no boogity man. There's no nothing around. I'm at home. Doors are locked. We're good. That's a very, very important practice in order to settle the nervous system and
right.
start to actually turn our attention to the beauty of life and to the things that actually are nourishing. And to desire love is a very nurturing thing. We want mm-hmm. to be loved and we want to express love, but we can't even touch that desire if we're in a constant state of fear and terror. Mm-hmm.
You're not going to believe this. We're about out of time. You were wonderful as always. We were talking with Dr. Syeda Desalay. She is the author of Desire. Where can people find you?
Great. Well, desirethebook.com is where they can check out the book. I have an amazing free book club, so desirethebook.club. Once you have the book, it's awesome. Free videos, a workbook that you can use to take yourself through the little handbook. It's like a pocketbook. Isn't it cute?
It's adorable. Oh, I love it. I love right? the way the book is designed.
You can sneak it in your purse, in your pocket.
Yes.
And you can find me at dareyourdesire.com. That's my website. But desirethebook.com is the place to get more information. It's a very easy read. And what's surprising me about this, Kelly, is that even I've met men who are like CEOs of IT companies and they're loving the book. I'm like, really? Wow, this is amazing. So I think it's touching a much broader audience mm-hmm. than my first book. And that's very exciting for me.
That's awesome. Thank you so much.
Can I say something that's possibly irrelevant?
Please.
I'm actually looking out a window right now at an intersection. And at that intersection is the exact location of my first therapist, my high school that I almost went to, and also on the other corner is where I went to this amazing exhibit that I basically cried at. And I think it's extremely poignant that on the other corner, I'm here listening to all of this, because it's actually quite powerful, and it's been amazing to hear all this. And I'm not going to lie, I have not read your book, but I actually am now. So this has been amazing.
Thank you so
Fantastic.
Much. Really
yeah,
appreciate
thank
it.
You. Thank you. You're amazing.
Awesome. All right. Well, take care. And everybody, we'll be talking with Dr. Syeda Desilets, the author of Desire. Thank you. So next week, the guest is to be determined. Still trying to figure that out. Follow us on Instagram at Two Shrinks. Our Facebook is The Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show. And our website's docandtherapist.com.
And if you want me to be the permanent co-host, just let Kelly know.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
You're listening to The Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.